I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Stephen Bowne joins me again. The acclaimed writer has just published a new book, The Company, The Rise and Fall of the Hudson's Bay Company. He looks at the 350-year history of the Hudson's Bay Company from a small trading concern in the inland subarctic of what would be Canada through to the political juggernaut it would become, influencing the culture and economy. Mr. Bowne discusses the relationships between the English aristocrats who came here and the indigenous then, through to the arrival of George Simpson, who assumed political control and invoked dominance in his treatment of the indigenous. He is one of history's greatest villains, and Stephen writes about him and his legacy. The legacy, the company, is thoughtfully considered in a new light, considering it's been about 30 years since Peter C. Newman's books on the Hudson's Bay Company. I asked Stephen about those books and where his book might differ. It's an engaging book, even though it's history we all know at this point. It's still a compelling read from the author of 10 books on the history of exploration, science, and ideas. Stephen Bowne's books on subjects such as the mystery of scurvy, the Treaty of Tordesillas, Captain George Vancouver, and Roald Amundsen have been translated into 9 languages and won many awards. His last book, The Island of Blue Foxes, was shortlisted for the RBC Taylor Prize. This new book is from Doubleday. Visit Stephen's website at stephenrbowne.net. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program, Stephen Bowne. Mr. Bowne, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. This is such a monumental achievement in terms of writing. I'm enjoying the book a great deal. But some people might ask you, Stephen, about why a book on the Hudson's Bay Company now, especially since it's been something that's been done before, if you will. What did you find, say, was lacking in those previous books? And I'm considering the Peter Newman books especially.
Yeah, I mean those Peter Newman books really set the benchmark for anything written on the Hudson's Bay Company. But they're over 30 years old now. Mm. And so I think this whole generation of people who really don't know or have a very strong grasp of just how truly all-pervasive and important the Hudson's Bay Company was to Canada's history and prehistory, and especially over the last 30 years, there's been a lot of additional research on, let's just say, like the pre-existing indigenous economy that predated the company's arrival in 1670. So we have the capacity to present a much more full and lively view of the world that the company operated in. And specifically, you know, when it comes to indigenous people and mixed heritage people, the role of the company's involvement in those communities has been understated. And you know, I enjoyed Peter's C. Newman's books. Uh-huh. They're perfectly good, but they're probably missing a quarter of the story, or at least the story is framed in a way which downplays the role of a huge group of people who were so vitally important to the company's success, and he was really missing that in his books.
And I think that sort of reflected his view of say, history. I mean, if you look at just his books on the Canadian establishment, they largely deal with important people or office holders rather than, say, people on the ground, if you will.
Yeah, that's true. And his take on the Hudson's Bay Company was very much that way, too. It was the stories are all presented from the point of view of the so-called important people who wrote journals about what they did. And, I think he's confusing the journal with the story.
Yeah.
And what I did is I looked at it and said, well, the journal is the information, but the journal isn't the story. And if you imagine yourself, I mean, this is what I used to do. Imagine myself floating above the scene once I had the knowledge in my mind.
Yeah.
And imagine how it was going to play out, almost as if I was sort of playing it as a movie. And if you do that, you have a very different point of view than if you get sort of locked into the tunnel vision view of following someone else's journey according to the daily journal that they wrote. So, yeah, I mean, you end up with, this has set the scene a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
in the late 17th century, just to merely get across the ocean was a huge undertaking. It required months at sea on a creaky old, you know, sailing ship dealing with storms and the scurvy plaguing all the sailors and navigating the ice in the Hudson's Bay. And then they arrive on the shore, and they don't know anything about how to survive there, and they don't know anything about the people who live there. So the first thing the company did, all of its employees who got there, who, I should mention, had to sign on for like 7-year contracts
at the minimum.
Many of them were there for decades because it was so difficult in the, you know, just getting there. The first thing they had to do was learn indigenous customs, learn indigenous languages, and sort of find a way to integrate themselves with the people who were living there. So the company was, right from the very beginning, a cultural enterprise as much as it was a business enterprise, and the two were interlinked, and they remained interlinked, and many of those company employees, right from the very start, married into those indigenous societies and immediately began having children who also were people who worked for the company. And, you know, that whole aspect of it, the full extent to which the company was not just a titanic British monopoly, but was, you know, an entity that was integrated into local societies has been overlooked.
It becomes a society of its own. It becomes it's largely seen, even today, as sort of a British company. But over 350 years, or at least the first 200 years, it eventually becomes a Canadian company in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, probably more than half of the people who worked at it were people of indigenous or mixed heritage. And then in its later years, even the people who weren't of mixed heritage were ones who were born in and around Montreal. So it was very much a Canadian company. But there is a pervasive view of the company as this gigantic, monopolizing British entity that was sort of somewhat corrupting and oppressive and had people under its thumb and controlled everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that view of the company, it is somewhat accurate, but that's what the company became by the mid and late 19th century. And like, as you alluded to, the first 150 years, which is an awful long time for a company to exist, the first 150 years, it was a very different type of entity.
Well, what were you mentioned these early people who came over and having to come here and learn about the land and establish relationships with the people already here. What were some of the attitudes? And because we think of a guy like George Simpson, you know, this bad guy. They didn't come here thinking like him, did they?
No. Like, George Simpson is a very powerful character who came, you know, basically at the time that the company was being amalgamated with the upstart Northwest Company from Montreal. And after 1820, and he entirely erased and replaced 150 years of corporate culture that pre-existed him and transposed his own somewhat odious concepts onto the company. Like, just to talk about Simpson a little bit more, what had gone before for 150 years was a very fluid, open concept where the people who worked for the company knew that they were integrated within those indigenous societies. So people all spoke the languages. Their wives and children were all part of those societies, particularly the Cree as they moved west across the land all the way into the Columbia River system on the Pacific coast. But George Simpson, what he did is he was definitely a racist, and I don't use that word very easily, but he absolutely was. He was a misogynist. He abused his employees. He basically used anyone and everyone to further his own very narrow objectives. And by the 1830s, he was letting it be known to his senior officers that they were not going to be eligible for promotions because of their indigenous or mixed heritage wives, and he began encouraging them to, you know, get rid of those wives and bring over some English ones. He also began not hiring the mixed heritage children of his officers to be in any senior positions within the company, which, you know, caused a great deal of conflict, but
right.
He was so powerful an individual, controlling all the information and was essentially an autocrat, that he was able to impose those attitudes onto the company, replacing the people over time with people who shared his point of view. And of course, by the late 19th century, when settlers were coming onto the European-type settlers were arriving, they looked to the only non-indigenous, you know, institution that existed there, and that was the company. And what they saw was Simpson's attitudes expressed in the people who worked there. And so because he was there for over three decades in such a powerful position, he completely upended a century and a half of prior tradition and, set a very negative precedent for what came afterwards.
Yeah, but before him, though, the relations, I mean, there's something fascinating about how people of the company interact with the indigenous here. And, I mean, can one glean lessons as to how those, say, relationships were cultivated and perhaps a way forward today, even in the relationship between, you know, the indigenous and the rest of Canada, say?
I think it is. I mean, look, if it can go from being really negative within one generation, which it did, it can also return to being something like it was before within one generation. And so, you know, I don't think history, you know, is a fluid thing. It's always changing. Everything's always changing. And everything would have changed in some way or another without, you know, if we hadn't gone on our current path, mm-hmm. we would have been on some other path. Nothing would be the same as it was in the 18th century. But, you know, during the 18th century, the relation, the company existed at the sufferance of those, you know, societies that it was servicing. And there was a much more, well, I would just say an open, more collegial relationship between the people who worked in the company and the people who were in the land around them. And there was a, you know, the career opportunities for all sorts of different people blended in and out of the company in a way that they just didn't in the 19th century. Mm. So, you know, the role of indigenous or mixed heritage people within the economy wasn't just trappers. I mean, there's often this view of, oh, like the so-called, you know, in the Peter C. Newman books, it was the Indians who brought furs in, and that was their sole role. That's all they did, and then we don't need to hear about them ever after. But in reality, any of these people operated as hunters, as guides, as laborers, and some of them, in fact, had nothing to do with trapping any furs. In the 18th century, most of the Cree were not doing any trapping of any furs. They were running their own commercial enterprises, and you know, which essentially they were using the Hudson's Bay outposts on the coast of Hudson's Bay as wholesale distributors, and they were running the retail aspects of the trade by themselves, you know, wending their way through the river systems all the way west to, you know, the Rocky Mountains during that era. And that was, you know, there's one classic example of that. There's a fellow named Anthony Hende, and in Alberta, Anthony Hende is somewhat of a well-known character. In Edmonton, there's, you know, I believe there's even a university tower named after him, but certainly there are roads and monuments. I mean, he's quite well-known across the prairies. And if you go on Wikipedia, you'll see the map and it'll show, you know, where Anthony Hende's explorations took him. But Anthony Hende wasn't the initiator of his own expedition. He was a hitchhiker. Mm-hmm. There was a fellow named Tikashish, and this is all from Hende's own journal. It's just been overlooked all this time, who took Hende on a two-year expedition. And so, all the way west to, you know, the Rocky Mountains and then back again, and showed Hende all the different cultures and the people that were going on, the horse riders and the buffaloes, and then brought him back to Hudson's Bay. And it's interesting that, you know, what to Hende is considered to be, you know, a great exploration worthy of his name being all over monuments and on maps and being on Wikipedia, you know, to a Tikashish who took him was his regular business circuit. So it does make you question, like, what does it even mean to be an explorer? Yeah. Like, what does exploration mean? If you hire a guide and a guide takes you on somewhere, are you really, you know, a grand epic explorer?
Right.
It's just a way of shifting the perspective on things. And why should we not know about Atikashish as much as we know about Hende? Hende wrote about him, acknowledged him as the leader of the expedition, and detailed their adventures together. And yet somehow Atikashish has been shuffled aside, probably because the journal wasn't written by a Tickishish, it was written by Anthony Hende, right? So anyway, there's a lot of that in the history, and it's those are things worth thinking about, I think. You know, why do we have one perspective on what it is to be a great explorer and not another? But Tickishish was just one of generations, and he was generations of people pursuing their business interests like that, merchant adventurers in their own right, and there was more than him. The Hudson's Bay Company called them the trading captains, the famous trading captains who would bring dozens of canoes in with all the furs, acquire a huge number of goods, and then disappear. And they were controlling all the retail aspects of the trade as far west, everywhere themselves. So the company didn't even really know what was going on then. So the whole world is a very interesting, when you start to think of it in those terms and understand a slightly different perspective shift, you realize, oh, okay, yeah, there's more going on here than we think.
So what was the process in terms of writing a book like this? I mean, there's a great deal of research. How do you find those sources that have been, say, untapped heretofore?
Yeah, I mean, the sources are fairly well known. I mean, there's not that, I should say there's a huge number of it, but it's a finite number.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, I've been working on this and thinking about it for quite a number of years now, but it's not so much that I found new information, it's that I found information that was presented in a very biased or very, there was a very narrow interpretation of that thing, and it was what I was alluding to earlier, like the people mistaking the journal for the story. And not highlighting enough or not presenting a fully accurate picture of the relationships between peoples and who was in charge of different expeditions and who the company's people were. You know, if you take a very narrow definition of the company's people were only the ones who signed documents in London, employment contracts, you're going to have a very definition of the company and a very different appreciation for what it was. And if you look at it and say, well, yes, a lot of the people the company was dealing with didn't keep legal records, but it doesn't mean they didn't have contracts and that those verbal contracts weren't binding and that people didn't know about them and that they didn't have functioning societies with rules and regulations. And, of course, we don't know all the details of it, but we know it existed. And so, you know, I just tried to cast the net wider and have a broader or more diverse appreciation for who the company's people were. And obviously, I mean, someone like a Tickishish made more money for the company than Anthony Hende did. That's absolutely for certain. And so in what sense would he not be considered one of the company's people? It's like saying, I think it would be like saying, you know, a real estate agent from Royal LePage isn't considered to be part of Royal LePage because they work on contract or something, right? Like, so, it's just a different, I wanted to just look at it a little bit differently and give a different idea of the Hudson's Bay Company and what it was. And, well, it's just such a fascinating institution.
It is, yeah. And it's one of those things, Stephen, that as I read your book, one realizes that without the company, Canada might not have happened.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, certainly there was, you know, in that mid-19th century, I mean, with U.S. expansionism and the calls for 54, 40-year fight, you know, and the desire to extend American Empire all the way to the Pacific Ocean and all the way up to Alaska, and you know, the only non-American institution and the only non-American people other than multitudes of indigenous people of different cultures and societies was the Hudson's Bay Company. And so, you know, when it came down to negotiations between like the British Empire, which was also claiming all this land, and the American Empire, which was claiming all this land, and there was Spanish Empire who was claiming land up from the south, and there was Russians. There's all these different empires competing. That, you know, the most powerful card that the British could play in their favor was saying, well, the only commercial entity that's there and has been there for many, many years is the Hudson's Bay Company. So how can you say that that's not part of the British Empire? Which, of course, is you know, whenever you're talking about empires, it sounds a little bit ridiculous when you present it like that. But that's the way that these empires were operating back then.
Yeah.
And that's undoubtedly the reason why the British Empire and was able to fend off legal claims with other empires, and that's which resulted in that lands, you know, becoming part of Canada.
This is, you obviously cover 350 years of history, and if, as a reader, it comes alive in the pages of your book. I'm wondering what it's like in your head, say, as you're writing it. Did you find yourself traveling back in time and immerse? I mean, how do you immerse yourself in those times? You know, in where we are now in 2020, say.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad to hear you say that. I might spend so much effort trying. That's my main objective, is to bring this whole world alive, and to you know, obviously I have a lot of background research and a lot of background, you know, writing and thoughts have gone into it, but I wanted to keep that in the background and make in the forefront. I want it to be, you know, interesting, exciting stories of people living their lives. And, you know, times are very different than our own, and the understanding of the world was very different than our own. So I put a huge amount of effort into that. I just imagine these people, you know, trying to imagine, like, what the world was like when if you had no map of anything. You didn't know, there's no roads anywhere, and there's no communication. Like, if you're lost, you can't just call someone up on your cell phone, or even send an email. There's no other mail system either. But you're actually just completely on your own, and just to try and, you know, I try and put myself in the mindset of how it would be to know so little of the world on a macro scale like that than what we would know now, the most basic information. But those people also knew so much of the detailed, you know, information that they needed to survive, such as, you know, plants and animals and weather conditions. So, you know, it's not like they had less knowledge. They just had completely different knowledge, and they were living their lives within a completely different psychological construct than what we live in. And yet they're genetically exactly the same as us. So, yeah, it's just it's a fun exercise to try and put yourself into someone else's.
Oh, I'll bet, yeah.
Shoes. But I'm happy that you think it comes alive, because that's where all the effort went into. Like, just to show how dynamic and exciting this world was, and how there was a great many things going on, like politics and culture and trade expeditions, and, you know, the economy was much more diverse and developed than what we think of it constantly. You know, we think, oh, that nothing existed until Canada existed, which of course is just not true.
In terms of how long this took, writing the company, I mean, it's not something that you can dash off quite quickly. I mean, how long did it take, actually?
It's actually 3 years now since my last book came out. But yeah, it's a lot of work. But this whole idea of the company is something that in the back of my head I had been thinking about for many years, even before that.
Yeah.
Like, just it always just felt to me like, there's something not quite right, you know, with that old Peter C. Newman approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that somehow we were missing some aspect of the story, which is, of course, all these, like, fascinating indigenous cultures and the economy that already existed in them, and the relationships between those people and the relationships that they had with the company and the relationships that, you know, the company employed them and worked with them and used them as explorers and guides you know, that's what was missing, and I really wanted to show all those connections and to, like, give a more accurate sense of how integrated the company became into all of these societies and how they, of course, informed the company's behavior as well. And, I just got a broader, more diverse understanding of just, you know, how complex the world actually was back then. It's not a simple thing with a few people catching some furs and trading it for some trinkets. You know, it's far more interesting than that.
And the story is relevant today. I mean, I'm sure you're asked this a lot about why we should know this, but I mean, if it's not clear already, it has great relevance to today, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe it does. I mean, I would think it would be hard to fully understand many of the issues that are prevalent in our society right now without having, you know, some grasp of this epic and monumental backstory and all the different phases that it went through and how it's shifted over time. I mean, how things change over time, I think, is just an important concept. And for whatever reason, it seems that people aren't as attuned to that as maybe in previous times. And maybe it's a lack of appreciation for history, but just the idea of change over time and how things can shift from one thing, how they can shift, you know, with the advent of a George Simpson, for example, or the advent of new technologies can completely change the way people interact. And it's happened multiple times over the past. And, you know, I think you can see that as both a positive thing and a negative thing. I mean, things that are good now can easily become not so good, but it's also completely true that, you know, that society can, in fact, move forward beyond some of the challenges and the problems that we've had in our history. It's happened. Change has happened before. Change can happen again, and it's up to people to, you know, get together and to force that change upon society with our own behaviors and our own actions. It can be seen as a very positive thing.
Indeed. Stephen, this is a very fine achievement. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it. It's nice talking again.
Yeah, it was good chatting to you. Thanks a lot for having me.
The website for more is at stephenrbone.net. The book is called The Company, The Rise and Fall of Canada's Hudson's Bay Company. It is published by Doubleday. Stephen Bone joined me on the line from his home in Banff, Alberta. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.